Hi, this is Adam Krakowski, author of Vermont Prohibition, Teetotalers, Bootleggers, and Corruption, a new book focusing on the history of Prohibition and the effects it had on the state of Vermont. And you are listening to Cider Chat.
They'll never think twice about looking in the granite quarry for us.
Don't look up until you hear them passing.
Goodbye, coppers. Hello, cider.
Prohibition.
Episode 34. That's what we call a wee bit of Ciderville fun. Hi, and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rio Wincolor, and I am your Cider MC. And if you haven't figured out by now, well, we are going into Prohibition with author Adam Krakowski. He wrote a book, and it just came out this May, and it's called Vermont Prohibition, Teetotalers, Bootleggers, and Corruption. So we're going to be hot on his trail soon, talking with Adam and getting a bit of history that is really pertinent to cider, and really, in truth, not just Vermont, because things that happen in one state often are mirroring other states too. And Prohibition was an epic event for the U.S., and it certainly had a major impact on beer, spirits, and our beloved cider. There'll be more on that chat in a moment. I'd like to thank a new patron at Cider Chat. His name is Justin, and he's just been fantastic in so many ways. One, because he's a patron of this chat, which helps it keep thriving. And also, he gave me some good ideas for some interview questions. I really appreciate that. And also reminded me that I was a little remiss when I was talking about stopping fermentation when bottling cider. And it's kind of like so funny because I just got a phone call that was going on with a friend of mine. Her name is April, and she made some awesome cider. She back sweetened it. It's fizzy, and she's really concerned about now having those kind of bottle bumps, and that means that they explode because the carbonation is so high, and the heat hits it, and it just kind of keeps cooking up. Perhaps you've had this query too? Well, hang on to your hats. At the end of this episode, I'll be discussing a bit more about what you can do, and also providing a link on the web that gives a more fuller description of this cider making technique. And this coming weekend, I'll be in Brooklyn, New York at the event called Pour the Core. This is my first time attending one of these events, and I'm looking forward to trying some of the ciders there, and I hope meeting you. I put out on Facebook a little cider meetup there. I'll be at both sessions, so do say, hey, Rhea, if you are there, and we could grab a glass and enjoy a chat together. And I will indeed be tweeting out at Cider Chat, and I suspect maybe during the event doing a little bit of periscoping and eventually posting on Facebook. So lots of fun this coming weekend in the beautiful month of June. So psyched to be in New York City. Now let's get on with this chat with Adam Krakowski. Adam is author of two books. His first book came out in July of 2014, and that's a book that he wrote with Kurt Stalder. It is called Vermont Beer, History of a Brewing Revolution. Now his newest book is called Vermont Prohibition. I've always had a really keen interest in learning all that I can about Prohibition, specifically in relationship to cider. Some of the things we'll be talking about in this chat is why Vermont actually has what is called an 80 years of prohibition, and the bit about the temperance movement, the difference between ethanol alcohol and methanol alcohol, and the law that was written to help cider avoid a bit of the prohibition pushdown. And did you know NASCAR's relationship to prohibition? That is a fun piece of history, too. There's much more in this chat. So without further ado, let's all grab a glass, head up to Vermont, and have this chat with Adam Krakowski, the author of Vermont Prohibition. In 2009, Adam entered into the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Vermont.
the first day they hand you a town. And I got Derby, Vermont. I knew nothing about this, and I just said, cool, all right, let's go. Project was to document the historic structures, the historic barns of the town and the area, and then write an agricultural history of the town. You see all dairy barns, butcher barn, and so forth, and then all of a sudden realize that even though it's all about dairy, in the 19th century it was about hops. Hop houses have a very distinct structure. You had a kiln, you had a drying area. I knew what style of barn I should have been looking for in the photos, and then I realized that there was nothing there. There was no standing hop house or hop-related infrastructure. When you travel through New England, you see the old ruins on the riverside of, you know, where it used to be a mill, and you didn't see anything. And that fascinated me, that you could actually wipe the landscape clear of something. I did a paper on the history of hop farming in 19th century Vermont, and I knew that there was a whole bigger story. And what happened was that I kind of alluded to that in my agricultural history of Derby. Turns out Derby, Vermont, was the largest producer of hops in Vermont in the 19th century. Vermont was the number two hop producer.
Wow.
And right
behind...
Who was
number one then?
New York, Otsego County, Cooperstown area.
Okay, yeah.
And ironically, that's where I did my undergraduate studies. And I realized in hindsight that a lot of the barns I saw were actually hop houses and hop barns.
So Adam decided to pitch the Vermont Historical Society to do further research. He soon became the recipient of the 2010 Weston A. Cate Jr. Fellowship. Soon, Adam met up with Kurt Stotter.
At that time, the executive director of the Vermont Brewers Association. All of a sudden, one thing led to another and ended up co-authoring together Vermont Beer, History of a Brewing Revolution, just based off the history and the current state of the Vermont brewing industry.
After finishing the Vermont Beer book with Kurt, Adam was left with a wee bit of a dilemma.
I actually had about 30 pages of material. From that, I basically realized I had enough material to start another book.
There was already a Vermont book on Prohibition written by a Scott Wheeler in 2002 titled Rum Runners and Revenuers, Prohibition in Vermont.
He actually captured the original oral histories about 10 years ago or so, and that was a huge asset. But this book, I wanted to really focus on politics, policy, economics, religion, and social impact that Prohibition actually had.
You kind of rolled your eyes a little bit when you said religion, because it must have had a huge impact on it.
It did. So to give you an idea, in 1820, Vermont had over 200 distilleries in the state. To give you an idea, right now, we have 16.
Wow.
We had more distilleries than towns. The amount of consumption that was happening in the U.S. at the time, in 1820, equated to about 7 gallons of spirit consumption per year. And to put it into further perspective, it's about 7 shots of spirit a day per man, woman, child. People always are shocked by the number, but you have to remember, this is before Louis Pasteur and germ theory. And all you know is that if you drink the water, you get sick. If you drink the spirits, you drink the beer, you drink the cider, you don't get sick. Cider and beer played important roles in Vermont, and cider was your everyday consumption drink. Beer as well, and it was mainly a source of carbohydrates. Cider was more used as consumption by everybody all the time. Little children, consumed it. Now alcohol, beer, and I'll use spirits and cider all together, is a social fabric. And the role that it plays, and an important role, back then it was safer to drink than water. And it was also your source of carbohydrates and nutrition.
I always wondered about that, because you're in Vermont and that crystal clear mountain water coming down, why would people think, I can't drink that and go to cider?
You know, it's one of those things that not all of Vermont is the mountains and have the streams.
True, true.
Believe it or not, we have down the road a few miles, a natural spring that has a tap that you can drink the tap water. And it says, still to this day, you know, consume at your own risk. You know, there's no reason to question the quality of the water, but you never know what happened. Back then, you didn't understand that necessarily. You know, spirits were a very difficult problem because beer and cider, you know, you were working a lot. And, you know, you have to understand that your average day was a long, laborious day. Spirits would get into problems with it. You know, 1820, you have the peak of the distilleries, but then you also all of a sudden in the mid-1820s have the rise of the prohibition groups and the temperance groups. And a lot of the argument was that there was a deterioration of the social fabric, that men were, and it was mainly men that were succumbing to alcoholism, to loss in production, public intoxication. You start seeing in the court records, 1830s, 1840s, these accidental deaths of drunk and falling asleep in the snow and, you know, succumbing to the elements. And there was a very stiff pushback from this group that started to gain momentum. Vermont, essentially, a few decades later, goes into prohibition. 1820s to 1840s is when the temperance movement gains traction. Vermont goes into prohibition. It's the second state in New England, 1853.
What was the first state?
Maine.
What was the last state?
I don't actually know the last state, because
must be Ciderville.
Well, it's interesting because Vermont goes into prohibition, and you know, and it's really remarkable because once it goes into prohibition, it outlaws spirits and beer. Mm-hmm. There's a provision, and this is really a slick way of writing the law, that cider was permitted if you happen to press the apples. They happen to ferment. As long as you don't adulterate it in any way and it just naturally fermented and you and your family consumed it, it was okay. Okay, 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 okay. Cider, it was okay. I mean, how do you outlaw something that you can press and let it sit right in the corner of a room in a container and it will become alcoholic and, you know, generally speaking, with the wild yeast? Kind of skirts the line with, you know, with prohibition, and it stays off of the prohibition books for about a decade, and then you start to see it creep in to the writings.
You mentioned that the prohibition came about because people were being found in the snow, and there was this like movement that the roots of prohibition was to have temperance over some of the wildness that was happening with libations at that time.
The libations at the time, you're talking about the sling, the flip.
What is the sling and the flip?
Sling and flip are both gin-based cocktails. And you see the gin being produced heavily. You see corn whiskey, potato whiskey being produced heavily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that I really, and it's important to kind of note, you know, the spirits that we drank back then are not the spirits we drink today. The gin that we consumed, the stills that we use today, the local distillery here would be Caledonia Spirits over in Hardwick, Vermont. You know, you have Mad River Distillers down in Waitsfield. The stills they use are very high tech. That the control they have is phenomenal in the run of the, you know, the wash of the spirits. And back then you didn't have that technology. Mm-hmm. You cobbled together what you had. You had a basic design. And what we consume now for gin, where, you know, you have the London Dry Gin or Old Tom, which is the barrel aged
Plymouth Gin.
Yep.
Yeah, really good.
We would have consumed somewhere of a hybrid between Genever, which is the ancestor of gin.
From the Netherlands,
and on the sweeter side, an Old Tom.
Okay.
And Old Tom is essentially a barrel-aged gin. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand, we didn't have stainless.
True.
Right. You know, everything got barreled. So even if it sat, and the whiskeys that we consumed back then, very rarely did you have a aged whiskey. it would age because it was sitting there while you were consuming it, so it gained more of the wood character and so forth. And it to me, it's kind of fascinating because you have an evolving beverage rather than what you have when you open the top and you're consuming what's in front of you. Right. The closest thing that you could do now is any wild yeast beer or cider that still has the lees in the bottle because it's still evolving at that point. When you consume a beer or you consume a whiskey, you can let it sit for 10 years on the shelf. It's not really going to change. It'll get oxidized and degrade, but it's not going to develop in nuances.
Another question, I just have to ask you this because it's so on the tip of my tongue. The words cider, it feels it got co-opted a little bit. And I wonder if you saw that at all in your research. And maybe you didn't. I mean, what were they calling fermented apple juice back then?
Cider.
They weren't calling it hard cider.
Nope, it was just cider. And the hard cider was kind of a late prohibition, from my research, 1880s, 1890s, you start seeing the hard side of it.
What did they mean by hard cider?
The fermented cider.
It was fermented. So do you know why that came about as a word change?
I really don't. When in doubt, I tend to figure that it was in the legal terms. And in terms of just that they had to make a clear differential between the two.
That's kind of what I understood a little bit with Prohibition, that it came in that way to separate that. Because like you said, people could make cider in their farm, as my grandfather did, and everybody would show up on a Saturday from the tales I would hear. And then they were really thankful that the horse knew its way home, because it would carry folks home that had drank, out of the barrel and that cider. And then they were, starting to cut it also with spirits, too. And that's where I thought it became hard cider, because it wasn't just purely fermented juice, but it had the distilled spirits in there.
They would put the distilled spirits in to essentially fortify it in terms of... people forget that alcohol is actually a preservative. And when you have something that it naturally ferments about 5%, sometimes a little higher, sometimes a little lower, when you can put a shot of whiskey in and boost it to, say, 10%, it's actually going to have a longer shelf life. The General Statutes of Vermont from 1863. It actually refers to cider, so in the middle of the Civil War, already 10 years into Prohibition at this time. And it discusses every town has to have a person in charge of overseeing the alcohol. And they kind of make it clear in the first section that adding spirits to anything falls under the prohibition. They actually make in the 1860s a clear reference to adulterating cider, with the term being adding spirituous liquors to. At that time, that's when you start to see hard cider as a name. You still see references to cider in general. It isn't until the 1890s that, you see pasteurization in Vermont. And until then, I have to make an educated guess that it's still hard cider. And in terms of what we know as hard cider.
Right, because it definitely is a little bit of confusing in the market in that way, and I was just kind of curious what you saw there. Going back to this book specifically, because I know you have some amazing stories in here on the history of Prohibition. How about lending us a little bit of that?
Falls into three categories, which is the macabre, which everybody loves a juicy story.
I do.
And spirits is really the elephant in the room, that it's everywhere. We share a border with Canada. It comes down. It's moving through. When you distill, you are essentially taking the alcohol vapors off of a fermented liquid. And at about 100, it's like 160, I believe it is, temperature-wise, that you'll get a run of methyl alcohol, which they in the distilling world is known as the head. It's lethal. It's methyl alcohol. Your body can consume ethyl alcohol, but not methyl. The sweet spot, or the body as it's known, is 100 80 to 100 or 200 thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And these are general, you know, degrees where there's a lot of precision in the distilling world. And that's known as the body, which is what you want to consume. And then you have the tails, which you, you know, are after the optimal range for pulling the distillate. And in Vermont, you find the macabre stories of people dying because they didn't know to discard the heads of the distilling, and they consume the, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the methyl alcohol. And right. It actually occurs, you know, people make references now about how, you know, oh, you might go blind. Mm-hmm. When you consume methyl alcohol, it actually deteriorates your optic nerve. And so you really did the first symptoms where you went blind. After that, your liver gets overwhelmed because it can't actually process the methyl alcohol, and it's a toxin, and the liver starts to go into problems, and then the kidneys, and it's just a bad day all around. Some people survived with long-lasting health implications. Most didn't. There was a case in Bristol, Vermont, where the pharmacist was selling alcohol out of the back of his pharmacy. And he unfortunately mixed up a barrel of wood alcohol and a barrel of ethyl alcohol. And I forget the exact number. I think it was 14 people he killed over the course of a weekend. And there were many more that survived but had long-term effects. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, a simple mix-up. And he ended up going to jail. He got pardoned by the governor. That it wasn't his fault for the mix-up, that he had placed an order with this firm in Albany, New York, and they sent the wrong barrel. But that same story occurs a few times around the state, and there's body counts. There's, you know, you kind of realize who's connected to who when all of a sudden, you know, the pharmacist screws up and then people start dropping, and, you know, and it's not just that town, but the neighboring towns. And what I found fascinating in this was the implications for the state. Tax revenue was so closely tied to saloons and the distilling. You hear stories about the degradation of roads, infrastructure, and there's a fascinating manuscript that's now at the Vermont Historical Society. And you start reading it, and it was a preacher in 1902 who is basically saying, we can't let go of prohibition. And if we do, all that money we're going to be getting, we're going to be paving the roads with the blood of, you know, the drunkards. There is a clear fallout once state prohibition goes in 1853 of tax revenues to towns. And you start to see some of the effects with, not uprisings, but, you know, murmurs through the town about, you know, well, we don't have enough money to fix this, we don't have enough money to fix that. So 1853 is state prohibition. In 1902, in the governor's race, have John McCullough versus Percival Clement. What's interesting is once prohibition goes on the books, 1853, the Whig Party is the party that brought it on. And within a year of getting prohibition on the books, the Whig Party is dissolved. They were losing elections, and the whole party just disintegrated. Republicans held rule in Vermont for 100 years. What was fascinating was that it was a political machine. The likes that it is really remarkable that you got groomed through the party. That you got into one position, you kept moving up the chain, and you know, and then ultimately you'd get into the governor's position. And John McCullough in 1902 was running as the primary Republican candidate. And interestingly, Percival Clement, who is a very well-known and well-established businessman from Rutland, comes in and he joins into this whole gubernatorial election. He was running for the anti-prohibition party, but he was a Republican. And so you have a Republican challenging a Republican, which really mm-hmm. had not happened mm-hmm. Prior. He ran on the high license local option ticket. That essentially said is basically, let's get prohibition off the books, let the towns decide, and then if they want a saloon, let's have a very high cost of the saloon permit mm-hmm. with that money going to the town. Percival Clement loses the 1902 election, but he pushed the platform so far that when John McCullough ultimately wins, and it went, actually, it was a contested vote to the House and Senate, mm-hmm. Or the legislature in Vermont to decide, John McCullough basically caves and agrees to lift prohibition and puts in the high licensed local option. The caveat, and this is why I say Vermont was essentially in prohibition for 80 years, was that it was an astronomically high tax to get that saloon license. And people don't realize there was also a population threshold. It was one permit for every 1,000 people. There was a lot of towns that just didn't qualify. So even though they voted to go wet, they didn't have the ability to. And that was one part of it. Most of the state was dry through the whole 80 years. A lot of towns that were next to neighboring towns with larger populations, where if one town voted no, I know that this was the case in Ludlow, Vermont. They were debating whether to go wet or not, and they were concerned because they were in close enough proximity that if they chose to go dry, that the town next door would go wet, and all of that town's money would go to the next town
get
over.
The benefits of that, yeah.
That ultimately is lay of the land till federal prohibition goes in. Mm. The delicious irony is that Percival Clement, who fought so hard to get prohibition lifted, ran for governor 3 times, finally gets elected governor, just in time to be the governor that signs in federal prohibition.
Oof. Wow.
And he was the last one, too. You know, Scott Wheeler has a great quote in his book. When he's saying, is Vermont wet or is it dry? He said it was always damp. And it's true, because if the towns weren't consuming the alcohol, the alcohol was moving through the towns.
Mm-hmm. Was it moving through, like, over the border from Canada?
Yes.
And going down into New York and
yep.
to Massachusetts?
So two important places, or 3 important places, I should say, was Burlington. Another was Barrie, Vermont, which is the next town over from Montpelier, and Lindenville.
Oh, so let's just kind of give Ciderville an idea that Burlington is about an hour south of the border, or an hour or more?
It's about 40 minutes south of the border on Lake
Canada.
Champlain. Uh-huh. If you're looking at the map, it's on the mm-hmm. eastern side. Montpelier is about an hour 10 south of the border, dead center of the state. Mm-hmm. Lindenville is about an hour south of the border, due on the eastern side of the state, sharing the border.
All about being an hour south of the border and you're in the hot spot.
It was connected on the rails and it was connected by car.
Sure.
And the big thing with Montpelier was that it was the central part of the state. Barrie's the next town over. Barrie had the granite quarries. Barrie mm-hmm. was renowned for its granite.
Mm-hmm.
And just think all those sheds, those
perfect
quarries.
Hiding spot.
Exactly.
Wow.
I tried to shy away for the most part on folklore and oral histories in the book, but there was one that I just really couldn't pass up. And it was about one gentleman who said about how much booze was moving through Barrie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was remarkable because one part that I really didn't touch on in the book was that there's a gentleman who remembers how if you wanted to make a quick buck, you could go talk to some guy who was connected, and he would go up, you could go up over the border at a location, pick up a car, and basically you had to get it to Barrie. They didn't want to know which route you were going. And
wow.
You would get into a shed, and you would pull it into a shed, and there would be at another location a pile of money. It's really come to light because of this whole resurgence of prohibition, is that NASCAR is essentially based off prohibition.
That NASCAR, the race.
Yep, NASCAR. A lot of those drivers ran hooch.
No kidding. Wow.
And back when it first started, and those cars were souped-up cars, because to run the booze over the border, you had to strengthen your shocks. You had to strengthen the frame. You wanted to have the faster, the bigger engine to outrun the cops. And those cars were essentially our supercars that we think of now.
Mm-hmm.
The engines were modified.
Sure. Is that where trafficking came about? I mean, we hear that like drug trafficking, but driving, the word traffic is a car terminology.
Yep. Yeah, it was, you had cars just running, you would hear these stories about, the chases on the back roads of Vermont.
Wow.
And, those cars, from what my understanding was, if police are talking about how fast the cars are, you have to figure that they have the best technology that's
yes.
on the public market. And the fact that these cars are outrunning the cops really says something, A, about not only the car, but the driver.
Right. With Prohibition and the Industrial Revolution, where people were leaving the farms, going into the city, I mean, that was really, in many ways, like a downfall for cider. And I just wonder, like, how much it really impacted the Prohibition in Vermont to, like, the common folks, you know, that did have the orchard. I was just visiting an orchard today that is, like, 90 years old, some of those trees. So folks are making those cider. You kind of mentioned that already in their backyard. It's a little bit easier to make cider than beer or wine or spirits or anything. I mean, wine would be, you know, easy if you could get grapes in Vermont, which...
Barry, Vermont was a huge Italian community, and they would get the grapes.
Get the grapes in there.
And okay. There were stories of, you know, the grappa, the quality of the grappa made.
Wow.
And, you know, so, I mean, it was there. The running joke that I heard was how once federal prohibition came into effect that they would forgive the fruit for the Lord, the religious wines. So, you know, the running joke was every family became Catholic. But what was interesting...
Wild.
What was interesting, though, that you touched on was how there were a lot of families that could actually apply to produce their own spirits, mainly table wine and cider. And they could, you know, they could purchase a permit and state that, yes, they are producing it. They're not going to exceed X amount. Currently in Vermont, I believe the bill just got bounced from the Senate to the House, which is marijuana legalization. And part of that bill is paying $100-something for a permit to grow two plants for personal consumption. And I see the direct correlation to what you could file and pay for back during Prohibition.
Can you read a little bit of that letter? That's on page 110.
The top of it is, notice of intent to produce wine for family use of the producer thereof, not in excess of 200 gallons, and not for sale or to be otherwise removed or consumed. And to the Collector of Internal Revenue, Burlington, Vermont, Sir, I, Rachel Colombo of 236 Berry Street, Montpelier, in the County of Washington, in the State of Vermont, hereby give notice that on November 25th, 1922, I intend to commence producing wine solely for my family use and not for sale at the otherwise removed or consumed, that I do not intend to produce 200 gallons of wine during the present vintage season. I therefore state that if I produce or have on hand at any time more than 200 gallons of wine during the present vintage season, I will give timely notice thereof on Form 698.
Wow, you know, what's striking to me about that is when I think about the year 1979, when homebrewing became legalized, right, with Jimmy Carter, and it was that 200-gallon. What is it about that 200-gallon mark? Because that's in Prohibition era 1920. What the heck, you know?
I wish I could give you a great answer on it,
yeah. But
the 200 mark, it was interesting because that counted for wine, that counted for cider.
Yeah.
Cider you could produce, and again, you couldn't adulterate it, you couldn't add anything to it, and if it just naturally fermented, you know, that's what you had. I find it funny because now we have folks like Shaxbury that make really remarkable natural fermented ciders, especially their Basque cider. At that time, it's a crapshoot on the Wild Easts. Mm-hmm. You know, now you can make cider or beer and you go to the market, you can pick God knows how many strains of yeast and select which one's going to bring the most nuance of it. Here during Prohibition, it was a crapshoot. You got whatever fermented. You could easily have 5 gallons of salad dressing.
True. Unless they had some family connections from the old world who knew how to make good cider from wild yeast.
If your fermentation goes south and you have vinegar, you got switchel. Which switchel, for those that don't know, is basically it was traditionally used during hang season, and it's basically 19th century version of Gatorade, where you would add the cider vinegar, ginger, maple, water, or at times just, you know, mm-hmm. you would cut it with fermented cider, and you would essentially consume that all day long while you're haying. And it's I find it very funny because now Switchel's finding its way back on the marketplace and also into cocktails. To me, sometimes I look at it like putting your Gatorade or Powerade into a cocktail. You know, that it served a specific purpose, and now all of a sudden we're finding new uses for it.
What is old is new again.
A big thank you to Adam Krakowski, author of Vermont Prohibition, Teetotalers, Bootleggers, and Corruption. Via the show notes at ciderchat.com, episode 34, you could find notable mentions that Adam discussed, such as the book by Scott Wheeler and some of the distilleries that he talked about in this chat. I cannot get that little ditty out of my head now. I hope it doesn't drive you crazy. It made me happy. You know, that little, it's called the roller derby theme that I put in helping narrate that story a little bit. And part of being happy and getting in the groove is what I really experience with cider and this community that I lovingly like to acknowledge as the land of Ciderville. Wherever you are, you have your own piece of the pie of Ciderville. And part of that is really staying in that positive attitude of abundance. And the first cidery that immediately comes to mind when I think about abundance is Current Cider of Percy, Pennsylvania. Cider maker Joe Getz of Current became the first supporter of Cider Chat's Cider Going Up campaign. Current Cider of Percy, Pennsylvania. The Cider Going Up campaign helps to support this podcast to continue providing informative chats from around the world with commercial cider makers just like you. For the same cost of only 2 bottles of cider per month, your cidery will not only be listed on the exclusive Cider Going Up campaign page at ciderchat.com, but you will also get loads of mentions on Cider Chat, which, by the way, has been downloaded via just one service on the web over 13,000 times. And best of all, you'll be supporting a podcast that is solely dedicated to promoting your craft. By going to a Cider Going Up page at ciderchat.com, it's easy peasy to sign on. And there are some new patrons of Cider Chat via the Patreon page who aren't necessarily commercial cider makers, but they said, heck, I want to keep this chat thriving. So a big thank you to Lisa and William. And you know, there's Patreon, there's also the donate page on Cider Chat. And recently, this amazing man, just last week, said the following. He sent me a great note. He said, full disclosure, I first came across your podcast while researching Nat West and what he's done in Portland to advance the cider business forward. When I played that episode and I began listening to the airlock bubbling and the funky jazz, I thought to myself, this sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit. What did I get into? Once I finished that episode, I was hooked. I think that's hilarious, Matt. That's like the highest compliment being related to Saturday Night Live. Dig it. I'll let the Medlars and Mr. Quince know. Since then, I've listened to about half the episodes and find myself learning something new each and every time. When I hear one of your guests speak and I know what they're talking about, it is a vindication that I'm making headway with the science and craft that goes into each batch. We went back and forth because Matt did donate some money to Cider Chat and was very gracious and felt like it was paltry, but I want to tell you that any amount helps. And if you're like Matt and thinking that way, I honor anything that you could help keep this chat thriving. But he also went on to say, I've learned more from your podcast than any class could teach. Holy smokes, right? By the way, he was headed to Portland, and he's based up in Spokane, for a 5-day extension class put on by the Oregon State University about the cider business, and says that he's completely stoked. And dude, I am so stoked for you. You just keep on going up in this world, and stay in touch, Matt. Thank you so much for being part of it. And thank you, Ciderville, and every one of you who has recently joined on the Cider Chat podcast Facebook page. It is so great being connected with you. Now, as promised, I want to get back to what Justin, the new patron at Cider Chat, had mentioned to me regarding stopping the fermentation when bottling so you can maintain a little bit of sweetness and sparkle to your cider if you like. You could do bottle pasteurization. And if you've done any kind of canning, this will start making sense to you immediately. And what will happen is that you immerse your bottles that are filled with cider at the point that you say, you know what, this is exactly the right amount of carbonation I have in here. I don't want it to go any further. I don't want the yeast to keep on kicking up the bubbles. I'm going to stop fermentation now at this point of bottling. So what you want to do is you want to have a couple bottles that, you know, maybe 2 weeks after you bottle it, you taste it and say, you know, this is perfect, or I'm going to wait a couple days. And you get that perfect point where it's, I want to stop it right now. So what you're stopping is the yeast. And I hate to do this to yeast because I really, really love yeast in so many ways in the world, but we have to kill the yeast. Is there a better word for it? I guess stop fermentation is kind of like collateral damage for yeast, but that's what you want to do. And you do that through a hot water bath. You have to be very, very careful, because if you put your bottles in without bringing them to a temperature, it's kind of like putting yeast in scalding water. You'll kill them immediately. If you do that with your bottles and they're cold already, or you haven't brought them up to temperature, they could really burst in the hot water bath. So it's a definite process that can be done, but it has to be done well if you have bottled cider. So you have to bring those bottles up to temperature. You only need to have them in like 180 degrees Fahrenheit for a minute amount of time to actually kill the yeast. I'm not going to get super clinical on that right now. Instead, I'm offering you a link to a fantastic posting with photos that can help you if you are in this process and want to stop your fermentation. Probably some folks out there in Ciderville, perhaps you have just bottled cider from last year and you're saying, dang, you know, it's just getting more and more carbonated, or I have some bottles cracking downstairs in the basement and I don't want this to happen. This is one of the tickets that you can do. You have to be very careful here, though, because remember, it's hot water that you're dealing with, and you have to stay on top of it. So that's bottle pasteurization. It's one other thing you could do. Check it out on episode 34 in the show notes. And I think I might even put this link on a resource page, too, because it's just so valuable. And I'm sure we'll be getting back to this again and probably talking to a commercial cider maker about this also. Thank you so much, Justin and April. Get to it. I know you can. I'm really looking forward to trying some of that cider. Well, now, I believe I am ready to roll out of here. This is Aria Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Every town has to have a person in charge of overseeing the cider.